Ring Talk Live Worldwide, brought to you by the WBC
with Pedro Fernandez.
Mighty Tower of Power. Straight up, you are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Check it, your inside look in the world of boxing and combat sports. On the line from New York City, I believe, the preeminent doctor in the world of boxing and brains. I'm talking about Dr. Nitin Sethi, of course, coming to us from Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital. He's an associate professor of neurology. I can go on and on, but the bottom line is it would take me an hour to read his resume. Bottom line is, Doc, how are you?
I'm good, Pedro. How are you? How's your health? How's family?
I'm excellent. I mean, everybody's taking the vaccine out here. So, I mean, California seems to be on the road to recovery. We're going to start to open things up. I hope to be able to promote a dance for some people in July and then September and then in October. So, well, I mean, I'm looking for good things. I'm hoping the world's coming back here.
Excellent. I'm glad you're in good health. Yes. And the same thing in New York. We are slowly but surely opening up.
Okay. How, as a doctor, how's this affected? How's this coronavirus affected you and your family? I mean, you see patients, and is there a certain risk involving seeing patients during the coronavirus and all that kind of good stuff, or what?
Yes, Pedro. You know, when the pandemic hit us in New York City in the beginning of like March, April last year, it kind of hit us like a tsunami. I mean, and before we knew it, so many New Yorkers were sick, as you're probably aware of. A lot of members from our boxing family got sick. Some of them, unfortunately, lost their battle to this disease. Mm-hmm. For me personally, Francisco Mendez, a brother to me, I used to train in Mendez boxing. He, unfortunately, lost his battle to COVID. So for doctors, you know, we were all redeployed to help out, help manage the COVID crisis. Some of us were sent to the emergency room. Some of us were redeployed to ICU settings, and it was tough time, and I think New York City really took the brunt of it. And I'm glad things are better now, and we're hoping that boxing and MMA comes back to New York State soon.
Okay, boxing had packed 73,000 people into a Dallas stadium a couple weeks ago. Some people thought that wasn't too smart, considering most people weren't wearing masks. So I'm going to go with my last pandemic question for you. I'm continuing to wear the mask for the most part in public. Do you think that's a smart thing to do, Doc?
I do. I think first and foremost, we should encourage people to get vaccinated. A lot of people are still hesitant about getting vaccinated. We should try to find out why are they hesitant. Try to address
politics. Doc, I hate to interrupt you, but my blood brother discovered me through DNA and genealogy about 3 years ago, and he's had a liver transplant. We had a lot of alcoholics in the family, but he had a liver transplant. So, I mean, science saved his life, right? He won't get the vaccine because he told me Bill Gates put a chip in it.
Right. So, you know, there are a lot of these concerns going around, health concerns. The vaccine will make me sick. Some people like these concerns about having a chip. It's going to change my genetic code. You know, I can sustain like your program, the way you're talking about it. That helps to allay people's anxiety. So vaccination, I think, is the backbone on which the world will open up. And then I personally, answering your question, I would say, yes, wear a mask. There's no harm in wearing a mask, especially when you are in a crowded arena. In fact, I think that should be the recommendation. You know, this disease is strange because you have to not just protect yourself, you have to protect others around you. And so, you know, it's kind of a collective responsibility. Everybody in the arena is protecting everybody else. I think that's just being sensible about it.
Okay. Dr. Nitin Sethi is our guest, of course, the Associate Professor of Neurology at New York Presbyterian Hospital and Cornell Medical Center as well. I got to ask you some questions. You know, as far as boxing is concerned, I used to watch guys get whooped up in the gym. And I used to whoop up on guys in the gym. In fact, I was a bit of a monster in the gym. And because I felt that you had to fight at the same, you had to train at the same speed you fought at. Some people disagreed with that method, but I didn't. Anyway, the bottom line is a lot of guys took lumps in the gym that probably bordered on concussions. Is that where most of the damage is being done, or a lot of damage is being done in training?
Well, Pedro, that's where I think the concern is raised, that are boxers suffering head injuries, concussions while they're training? And this does not just apply to professional boxers. It might apply to people who are doing amateur boxing. And I think the reason why it's important to talk about this subject is because these concussions and head injuries can be prevented. I mean, a sparring, a training camp, you know, these are controlled environment. Everything is controlled. It's not like it's not a fight going on where things are not under your control. So if you are sparring, you have a trainer, you know, there's no reason for people to suffer head injuries and concussions while they're sparring. And as you're probably aware of, in some fights which happened recently, concern was raised that the boxer entered the fight after he had suffered a concussion while training. So are some of these boxers getting concussed in their training camp and they're coming into the fight already concussed and not fully recovered? That's one thing which I think the boxing community has been looking into. A lot of concern has been raised, and I think we should discuss about that.
Yeah. In 1989, Rico Velasquez fought in San Jose for the California Lightweight Championship, and he had been knocked out in training by Romero Adames a couple months earlier in Harlington, Texas, and he went into convulsions. They never told anybody about it. I found out when I did a little expose after the fight, but he went into a fight having been in convulsions just like 6 weeks earlier, and he died. That was unfortunate, but you see this. That was obviously a preventable death.
True, and so exactly. You know, you should not have a boxer who's concussed entering the ring. Absolutely not. So it's very important that we have some mechanism where, first and foremost, we can identify these concussions which occur during training. The reason I say that identify, because as you and I last spoke, a lot of people still don't realize a concussion, the symptoms of a concussion can be very, very subtle. You know, you walk into a stiff jab, you walk into a right, your bell is rung a little bit. You feel a little off, little glazed look. You know, you feel a little bit subjective headache, a little dizzy. You feel as if I'm slightly off. You know, a lot of people may not realize that might be a mild concussion. You know, the lights are bothering you after that. The sounds are bothering you. You have a little ringing in your ear. Those are concussions. Now, they are very subtle. That's the reason why sometimes they might be missed in the training camp and people are going all out training for a fight. And like I said, first and foremost, you don't want concussions to occur in training. Why keep adding on to the burden of brain damage? All these concussions add up. You can say that some concussions are inevitable during a fight. They are going to occur. Boxing is a contact sport. You are going to see concussions. But why not prevent them while sparring? Why not prevent them during the training camp? Because in the end, they all add up. It's the total number of concussions which is going to determine what happens to this boxer's health long after his or her career is over.
Okay, Doc, I got Dr. Nitin Seti is our guest. I got to ask you about the world of mixed martial arts and the UFC especially. They don't throw in the towel at all, Doc. I mean, they're fighting these guys like they were just pieces of meat thrown out there until you just like they're death match after death match. And unfortunately, this isn't professional wrestling where guys really aren't getting that hurt. These guys are getting hurt. These are real death matches. So, are you seeing any of the residual effects of these guys getting kicked in the head and being choked out, that kind of stuff? Is it different from boxing? Is it more severe than boxing, or is it just look worse than boxing?
I think, Pedro, that's a good question. It's hard to answer that. You know, MMA is still quite a recent sport as compared to boxing. Boxing, you know, it's been around for a longer time. We kind of know the dangers of boxing. MMA, as you're aware of, it's just not hits to the head. There are these chokes, a vascular choke. You know, there are all these submissions by different types of submissions. So exactly how much was the injury burden? I think the data is still coming out. But what I always say whenever I talk about boxing, MMA, and I have boxed, I love the sport of boxing, I'm passionate about it, is that nobody can defend boxing by saying boxing is good for the brain. as a community of people who like boxing, who promote boxing, we are passionate about boxing, all of us should acknowledge that the risk that boxing poses to the health of these athletes. Once we acknowledge that, then we should try to figure out how can we make the sport more safe. I think that's a sensible thing to do, whether it's boxing or MMA.
Okay. Is a smaller glove the answer in boxing? In other words, is it better to take one sharp blow and have your bell rung than to take 90 softer blows?
It's a good question, Pedro, and I don't know the answer. You know, there are people who give me – I'm a student of boxing too, and I have asked this question to trainers, people who, you know, professional boxers. You know, with respect to this training, I can – What we have recommended recently in an article we wrote is that sparring should always be done with 16 ounces gloves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's probably the best thing to do it. Exception is big heavyweights who may use an 18-ounce glove. Under 150 pounds, you may use a 14-ounce glove. Use gloves which are made by a good manufacturer. You know, those are the things which you can do, simple things which protect you from head injuries during sparring and training.
Wow, you brought it all up there. I mean, the gloves, I used to wear the 14-ounce gloves, and they were custom-made for my hand. I had a guy making gloves for me. The great Flory Flores, Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay said that the greatest gloves in the history of boxing were the Flores boxing gloves made in Burlingame, California, and Ray Flores and Ali were tight through the 1960 National Golden Gloves, and then Everlast came along and wrote Muhammad Ali a bigger check.
You know the history of boxing better than me, Pedro.
To an extent, a little bit. I miss Ray Flores. He had a bar. He used to make these boxing gloves in a garage in Burlingame, California, which is about 30 miles from San Francisco. And he would make these boxing gloves in his garage in the back of near his house in Burlingame, California. He was also a bar owner, so he was a character, no doubt about that. And Cassius Clay and Muhammad Ali loved him, no doubt about that. Now, back to questions for Dr. Nitin Sethi, of course, our brain expert. Now, I got to ask you about transgender athletes. Now, I'm of the opinion that men are men physically, and when they cross over to females, they seem to be annihilating female competition in combat sports. But yet, when you put it the other way around and have women transforming to men, they don't seem to win.
Yeah, so, you know, the transgender athletes, should they participate in combat sports? You know, there's a lot of ongoing debate about this, you know, and you can kind of, the way I look at it is, let's assume you have a transgender woman and she's fighting against a cisgender woman. So a transgender woman is basically somebody who was biologically born a male and she has transformed into a woman now, and she's going to fight a woman who was born a woman and is a woman. Now, concern is raised that the transgender woman in this case, she has by the time the professional career starts, she has already acquired the bony structure, the musculature of being the male, because puberty has set in. So if you let a transgender woman fight a cisgender woman, you're worried the fact, like you said, that, you know, that's not a fair competition. You're worried about the health and safety of the cisgender woman. Now, you can try to say, well, you know, the flip side, let's assume you have a transgender man fighting a cisgender man. That means a person biologically was a woman and now he has transformed into a male. Okay. Again, and he's fighting a person who's born a male and is still a male. Now, the problem is raised is by the time he transforms into a male, puberty has set in, you know, by the time he launches his professional career. So he still has the musculature, the skeleton of a woman. And so now you're worried about this transgender man because you're worried about the fact that the cisgender man might have more advantage. So I think the way to look at this is, how can we try to make sure that, you know, there's a level playing field? So in the end, we want two equally skilled and matched athletes competing in the ring or cage at a level playing field. Okay, so you don't want to have health concerns and safety concerns for any of those two combatants. So I think those are important issues which combat sports will have to deal with.
Okay.
You know, what I do strongly feel is transgender rights are an important issue. And, you know, the combat sports community, like you are talking about it, we should talk about them. We should support transgender rights. You know, we should support the gender identity of an individual, you know, not discriminate against them. But how do we go about making sure that it's safe to do this? that's something where we have to study the science, and the science will give us answers. How do we approach this? Should we allow it? Should we not allow it? And if we allow it, how do we ensure that it remains a fair, competitive contest and is safe for all, both the combatants?
Doc, I got to cut you off on that. Dr. Nitin Sethi, our guest, no doubt about that. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you in a few weeks, Doc.
You're welcome, Pedro. Take good care.
The great Dr. Nitin Sethi, of course, Mr. Brain Doctor on Ring Talk Live Worldwide.